Welcome to today's teleconference. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, there will be an opportunity to ask questions during our Q&A session. Please note this call may be recorded. It is now my pleasure to hand the call over to Mr. Bill Hamilton. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. So I want to call your attention today to full-page newspaper ads by Evangelicals for Darfur, appearing in today's New York Times, Washington Post, USA Today, and in a host of other newspapers around the country. If you need a PDF of that ad, please let us know at the end of the call. I'm going to quickly introduce these five evangelical leaders, and then we'll turn it over to them. Each will make a brief statement, and at the end we'll welcome questions. Please direct your questions specifically to one or more of the participants. And because we're a bit far-flung this morning, it would be helpful if each speaker will identify himself when he speaks. If there are any issues that need to be addressed after this call, please call either Jack Pennell at Sojourners. That number is 202-745-4614. Or Alex Howe. His number is 202-822-5200, extension 245. Finally, within an hour or so after the conference ends, we'll have an MP3 recording to share with anyone who wants it. If you want to have a copy of that, please call either Jack or Alex. With that, I'll introduce the speakers, go over the spelling of their names, and then get out of the way. You'll hear first from the Reverend Jim Wallis. That's W-A-L-L-I-S. He's the president of Sojourners Call to Renewal, which is the nation's largest progressive Christian network. And he's the author of the book God's Politics. He's on the phone from Denver. Dr. Richard Land, L-A-N-D, is president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, which is America's largest Protestant denomination, with 16 million members worshiping in 32,000 churches in the United States. Dr. Land is in Washington, D.C. Ted Haggard from the National Association of Evangelicals is unable to be with us because of a pastoral emergency that took him out of phone range. In his place, we have the Reverend Richard Cizik, C-I-Z-I-K, who's Vice President for Government Affairs of the National Association of Evangelicals, which is for half a century, a fellowship of evangelical denominations, reaching approximately 5 million churchgoers. And I believe he's speaking from, well, I'm not sure he can say where he's speaking from. The Reverend Samuel Rodriguez, R-O-D-R-I-G-U-E-Z, is president of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference, serving some 15 million evangelical and born-again Christians, and he's speaking from Sacramento. And finally, the Reverend Jeff Tunnicliffe, that's T-U-N-N-I-C-L-I-F-F-E. He's the international director of the World Evangelical Alliance, which is a network of churches in 127 countries, reaching 420 million evangelical Christians, calling in, I believe, from Toronto. So, gentlemen, if you will. Finally, within an hour or so after this conference ends, we will have an MP3 recording. If you want that recording, call the two gentlemen we mentioned earlier. Reverend Wallace, can you start?
Each day that goes by, more people are killed in Darfur. Each day, more women are raped. Each day, more villages are burned. 400,000 have died, and 2.5 million are displaced. The world has called this genocide and allows it to go on every day. Because of politics, the world seems unable to do anything to stop the horrors of Darfur. So people of faith must act, and we must act quickly to save lives. This is an important day. You see evangelical leaders from across the political spectrum coming together to speak as one voice, Evangelicals for Darfur. We do not always agree on other political matters, but we are united in our commitment to saving lives of our sisters and brothers in Sudan. Scores of men, women, and children created in God's image who are being torn from their families and led to certain death with each passing day. And the ad says it well. Without you, Mr. President, Darfur doesn't have a prayer. We are appealing to President Bush to act on his faith. We are speaking as people of faith to have him act on his faith, to take strong leadership and do whatever is necessary to place a multinational peacekeeping force in Darfur. The UN peacekeeping force must be deployed now. and whatever is necessary to do that now must be done. And so we're asking the president to make this among his highest priorities and to act to save the people of Darfur. Those of us who are speaking have not often spoken together on very many matters, but on this we are coming together because of our faith. And I hope that this can become perhaps a tipping point to finally turn our moral energy toward the people of Darfur. We cannot let this happen again, yet every day it is happening. So we feel it's time for us to speak and act in faith, and we're asking the president to do the same. Thank you.
This is Dr. Richard Land, and I want to commend what Jim has just said and say that this is really a profound moral test for the world community. We just cannot allow the 21st century to begin with the kind of genocide that the 20th century ended with in Rwanda. And unless the president acts to rally world leadership and the countries of the world to put pressure on the government of Khartoum to stop this genocide, and we unless we put a military force in place, a multinational UN force, the genocide will not stop. This really takes us to one of the most profound moral questions that the world faces in the 21st century. The most grievous and grotesque violations of human rights are often being committed by governments against groups within their own country, which is exactly what's happening in Darfur. And the world community needs to find a way to overcome the impediment of national boundaries where you have the perpetrators of the genocide, in this case the government in Khartoum, exercising a veto power over what can be done to rescue those who are the victims of the genocide. And we have come together in this extraordinary coalition completely across the evangelical spectrum to say, Mr. President, we will do everything we can to rally support in the Congress, in the country, and in the UN to help you rally the support that is necessary to put pressure on Khartoum to cause them to allow this to happen or, if necessary, to defy the genocidal government of Khartoum and make it possible for a multinational force to be put on the ground to stop this genocide. Without a multinational force with the teeth, military teeth necessary to protect these people, this genocide will continue. And every passing day, Khartoum gets closer to its goal, which is the genocidal ethnic cleansing of Darfur. And the world community must not allow this to happen. We cannot say we didn't know. We know. And knowing, we have a moral imperative to act.
Reverend Sizek.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Rich Sizek. I'm speaking from the road. I hope you can hear me. I've been on a tour, if you will, speaking to evangelical college leaders, administrators, and particularly students on the subject of evangelicals and international affairs. And I've just been in your territory, Richard Land, in Nashville, and I'm on my way back to Washington, having spoken there at Nashville to the Tribeca Nazarene leadership as well as the college students and previously that, the Assemblies of God in Springfield, Missouri, Evangel University, Houghton College in upstate New York, and the rest. The point here I would like to make is that evangelicals are often cast as simply domestically concerned. We know the story as we're portrayed often. I think the other story that is unfolding here is not simply the genocide in Sudan, but the changing of a mood by American evangelicals on the subject. I picked this up even yesterday with Nazarene leaders who want it understood that we are, as Nick Kristof has dubbed us, the new internationalists. And we stand, in my opinion, in the best position to not just use our national influence here on this White House and our own government, but around the world as evangelicals. And Jeff Tunnicliffe will speak to that as well. I believe that the strongest voice, I've watched the ad campaign unfold and have been involved in this issue for a number of years, very actively so. But I believe the voice that is needed and is, frankly, the most influential is the evangelical voice. And when our people speak, not unlike in the economic community that listens as the ad campaign to E.F. Hutton, I believe in the political, in the international arena today that when evangelicals speak, governments listen. I know, for example, and without elaborating too much, in my speaking to Arab leaders, that they are interested in what evangelicals think, don't always understand us, but I think not just the Arab leaders, but the international leaders in European powers need to bring their pressure to bear here as well, to do as Richard and Jim and the others will say, if need be, to defy the genocidal regime in Khartoum in order to put a multinational peacekeeping force on the ground. The evangelical leaders first spoke unifyingly so in the summer of 2004, calling even then for enforcement of a no-fly zone, the funding needed to put troops on the ground to support the AU. And so we call again for that kind of definitive leadership by this president, who I believe has the right instincts, but needs to use greater use his voice, his bully pulpit, even more so on this issue. And if, frankly, if we fail as evangelicals, I think people die. And so it is incumbent upon our own community to raise its voice, and thus we together, not always in agreement here, those of us on this conference call on other issues, but agreed most assuredly, strongly, affirmatively on this topic. And I'm just pleased to be with these other leaders who have joined us here today. Thank you.
There is a query in that introduces the Good Samaritan parable.
This is Reverend Rodriguez.
Who is my neighbor? And this query, this question, and corresponding response reflects the moral impetus behind the evangelical leaders coming together in what Reverend Wallace and I would agree would describe as an unprecedented, in an unprecedented manner, to call for immediate intervention in the crisis in Darfur. While we do reflect different political streams together, today we come together via the stream of justice, compassion, and mercy. And when politics does not act, God-fearing people must initiate the call for justice. And the Hispanic Church and the Hispanic American narrative, as you well know, is centered around the threat of the familia. Well, our global familia is suffering. Our fellow brothers and sisters in Darfur are dying. 400,000 people have died since the genocide began in 2003. And today, these evangelical prophetic voices arise to call for an end to this genocide. The increase in violence has put the humanitarian life support system on life support itself, and the scenario continues to become more and more bleak. We need intervention. The NHCLC joins with Reverend Wallace and his entire coalition in order to call to our president to act now, to restore security, improve diplomacy, and ensure sufficient political pressure gets the job done. We need the president to utilize economic and political pressures in order to stop the genocide, beginning with a UN peacekeeping force immediately. So that question of who is my neighbor is the woman being raped, the child mutilated, the men murdered, the villages burnt. My neighbor is Darfur, and we must act now.
This is Jeff Tunnicliffe from the World Evangelical Alliance. Representing a global community of 420 million evangelical Christians, I really bring the voice of those Christians into the American situation. And the plea is from our global community to the U.S. president that he would specifically act. Whatever policy needs to be shaped whatever action needs to be taken economically or politically, we're urging him to take it for the sake of the people of Darfur. The killing must end, and we know that if the African Union forces leave, we're facing 100,000 people potentially dying a month. And the evangelical community around the world are saying, not on our watch. And we know that the crucial role that the U.S. president plays in all of this. And we also want to say that we are committed as a global community to influencing the European Union and other key nations around the world, as we're already doing. And so we want to back President Bush by saying we will take the same message to the leaders of the other European countries, to China, and all the other influential nations that can have an impact on Khartoum. Again, we have to say we must not allow this genocide to continue. We must say not on our watch. We must take action. And we believe that the U.S. is in a pivotal role today in this global situation to take action. And so we're pleading with the president to take action, and on behalf of the global evangelical community, a large community around the world, we're saying we're willing to serve, we're willing to provide economic and help, we're willing to provide humanitarian care, but the political action must be taken, and getting boots on the ground to protect the people of Darfur. So we're committed to that, and we look forward to working with our U.S. colleagues to ending this genocide in Darfur.
Sonny, I think we're ready to do the questions now.
Yes, sir. At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the star and 1 on your touchtone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, you may register your line for a question by pressing the star and 1 on your touchtone phone. We'll pause just a moment for questions to queue. We'll take our first question from Neela Banerjee with the New York Times. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Neela Banerjee with the New York Times. I guess all of you had such interesting things to say, so it's hard to pick the person that I want to direct this to, but I would say maybe to Richard Land, but also if anybody else wants to respond. You know, if I recall correctly, you spoke in the April rally here in D.C., and evangelicals and others have been speaking out on this issue. What is happening right now, or that has made all of you come together? Have there been particular events or confluence of events that have made you decide to take this action now, as opposed to, you know, 6 months ago, is there something in particular that's going on that's forced your hand?
Well, I think it's the fact that what we're seeing is concern, and talk, but no action.
Mm-hmm.
And people are dying. And we've reached a tipping point here where if we don't do something to get this on the front burner the president and the front burner of the country. And I believe that the president does care deeply about this. I've been told that he's the one who raises this in administration circles, not his advisors.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see this as helping to strengthen the president's hand.
Mm-hmm.
to enable the president to do what I believe the president does want to do, what's in his heart to do, and that is to rally the world to say, we're not going to let this century be as ugly and as bloody and as barbaric as the last century, and we're not going to allow governments to commit genocide against their own people.
Mm-hmm.
And we believe that this is a critical moment because people are dying every day, and the African Union forces are literally overwhelmed. And we believe that this is a critical test for the world community, and that would-be perpetrators of genocide in other capitals around the world are watching closely.
Mm-hmm.
To see if we're going to allow the gangsters in Khartoum to get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
I would add, Neela, Jim Wallace talking. I would
Thank
add,
you.
Neela, that mm-hmm. your question almost answers your question
mm-hmm.
because you speak to other rallies, other statements, and somehow what's happening in Darfur falls off the front page again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I would challenge all of you that Darfur should be on our front pages mm-hmm. until it's resolved. So this is our effort to put this issue on the front page of our consciences mm-hmm. and to put it on the front page of our newspapers, and mm-hmm. that until we resolve this, we can't stop talking about it, and we mm-hmm. continue to stop talking about it, and the killing continues to go on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Our next question comes from the site of Alan Cooperman with Washington Post. Please go ahead.
Yes, my question is also for Dr. Land. There has been an effort by some evangelical leaders in the past few years to broaden what has been the traditional agenda of evangelical issues, including such things as global warming and AIDS and Darfur and torture, and the list goes on and on. Dr. Land, you have joined together with some of these folks on this particular statement. But do you have any qualms about the broader agenda or the broadening of the evangelical agenda? Do you feel that in so doing, the maybe core issues, life issues, et cetera, are lost, reduced in stature?
No, I don't think they're reduced in stature. You know, if you're familiar with Alan Hirsky's book, which I know you are, you know that his book Freeing God's Children, evangelicals have been part of a coalition that have been trying to work on human rights and religious freedom issues around the world, and human trafficking issues, and the AIDS issue in Africa, and other issues as well, for many years. And I think it is true that in many ways the evangelicals are the new internationalists. I saw a study last year that showed that evangelicals were more open to American involvement with these types of issues than any of the other religious constituencies in the United States. And as long as the leaders of evangelical groups are expressing the consensus of their membership, I don't see it as in any way lessening concern on other issues. You know, we're able to keep more than one ball in the air at the same time. And you know, Alan, I wrote a book called The Earth is the Lord's, calling for earth care and calling for Christian stewardship of the environment in 1992. And it was very well received in Southern Baptist circles. We had a whole conference on it. So many of us have been involved on these issues for a long time and have said that, you know, if we're commanded by Jesus to be salt and light, salt and light is to be applied to all of society. We're to seek to make a difference where we see injustice and where we see wrong in every area of society, and that command to be salt and light doesn't stop at the borders of the United States.
Yeah, this is Jeff Tunnicliffe. Perhaps I can add that as the world evangelical community, we welcome the broader involvement of evangelicals in the U.S. to these issues, because it's a reality for many evangelicals around the world that are faced with HIV/AIDS, problem of global warming, poverty, trafficking. And so to have evangelicals in the U.S. Engage in this is absolutely crucial to be, as a part of the global community of evangelicals.
Next, well, we'll go to the side of Tony Carnes with Christianity Today.
Yes, hi, gentlemen. This is Tony Carnes from Christianity Today. I'm wondering if you have any plans to go to Darfur, Sudan, and talk to the leaders there, and if you've already done that, or any of your number have done that, and are you going to reach out to African churches, the Anglican Church in Darfur?
Jim Wallace speaking here. I should have said we have asked for a meeting at the White House. The president, I think, it would be good for us to meet with him and to strengthen his hand and showing leadership here. So we've asked to meet with him. There's been conversations about whether a delegation at some point makes sense. I think what we're saying is it's time to do whatever is necessary. And so we'll be talking. This isn't the end of this campaign. It's the beginning. Well, it's part of a longer campaign been going on for some time. It's focusing our voices and our energies. But all those ideas I think are on the table. If it would take a group of evangelicals to go to Darfur, to Chad, with a specific mission and a message, we may in fact decide to do that, meeting with at the White House, meeting with whoever it takes. It's time for us to act and do whatever is necessary. That's what we're saying to the President of the United States, and that also applies to us.
Can I jump in and answer that one?
Sure.
There is a small delegation of evangelical leaders who are making a trip, in fact, in 3 weeks to Rabat, Morocco, for the purpose of building our bridges with the voices of moderate Islam. Four or five of us will be going, and it's against the backdrop of all the rest that is happening in that part of the world. Look, Americans usually ignore history. It was a man by the name of Ambrose Bierce who once wrote that war is God's means of teaching Americans geography. In other words, that we only learn about places when we're at war with them. And a similar thing could be said about Americans in history. Look, Americans are always emphasizing new beginnings, new ages. We need to start out, as Richard said, the 20th century, 21st century, in a way that is different than the 20th century. But one of those issues which I raised earlier is, namely, the voice of moderate Islam has to speak to Khartoum, and in each of my trips there to Rabat, I have asked King Mohammed VI and other leaders to press Khartoum, and we'll do that again on this trip. And we know there's a battle that's going on for the soul of Islam. It's torn and divided, and yet they are the ones who are going to have to decide this most of all, and we can play a part, but our part is, I think, at least on this issue vis-a-vis Islam, is recognize and support the voices of moderate Islam, and we must defend them from their enemies within their own religion, for extremists are our enemies too. And so this is just a part of the picture, but I think it's not insignificant.
And Tony, if I could just add to that, the Arab League has offered to send a force of Arab and Muslim peacekeeping troops to Darfur, because you know we need to understand that this is Muslim upon Muslim violence, and the extent to which we can get Muslim countries to agree to be the backbone of this UN peacekeeping force, it will be all to the good. And last week, the Arab League did offer to send a contingent of peacekeeping troops, which I think is a very positive sign.
Next, we go to the side of Rachel Zoll with Associated Press. Please go ahead.
Hi. This is a question for Dr. Land, and I guess for Rich Cizik. You talked about the fact that the president has this in his heart to do this and to make this a top issue. What do you think is preventing him from doing that? Why isn't it happening?
Well, I think it's lack of popular support in the administration and in Congress. Concern that this is another commitment that we can't make as a nation, and the lack of sufficient demand from the American people that something be done. It's been my observation that in Washington, when Washington feels the heat, they see the light. And what we're hoping to do is to get this on the front burner, to get this on the front page, to get this as the lead story in the nation's media, and to get this to the place where the American people demand of their congressmen and their congresswomen and their senators that they are talking to the administration and saying, you need to do something about this, and we will back you when you do it, and talking to the UN and saying, this has to be done. The president has really been doing more than just about anybody else in terms of saying that this is genocide and saying that something has to be done, and trying to put pressure on the Sudanese government. But the president cannot do it alone, and America cannot do it alone. But I think the sad and tragic lesson that we learned in Bosnia and Herzegovina and in Kosovo and in Rwanda is that unless America takes the leadership role to encourage the rest of the world to act, something doesn't get done. And I could, you know, I argued vigorously for intervention in Bosnia and Herzegovina, and I applauded President Clinton for his eventual intervention in Kosovo, and joined with him in lamenting that we didn't do something to stop what happened in Rwanda. Now that does not, let me hasten to add, that does not mean that in this case we should use U.S. troops. I think that would be counterproductive. But providing logistical support and providing the leadership to put pressure that cannot be resisted, or by Khartoum, or to defy Khartoum in the end, the world community just saying, we're sorry, we're not going to let the perpetrators of crimes against humanity stop the world community from stopping crimes against humanity.
Great, thank you.
I would simply add, Richard is exactly right. I was among those, too, that urged, as did NAE, action in Kosovo. Look, what I think is occurring here, or I fear is occurring here, is an unwillingness to push lest we upset a Muslim capital that is led by extremists, who will then call in other extremists to fight the Crusader West. Look, America was attacked by terrorism because it is the world power. The barrier to the goal of terrorists, and to be immobilized at this point on Darfur, in my opinion, is to concede something we should not concede. And that is our capacity to lead and to act. I am not for, nor are any of us for, putting American troops on the ground. But we must act as a world community, and America must show that it's still the leader. And so I believe that moderate Islam can help here. We support them. They support us. It's important against the voices of extremism, period.
You know, it's often the case, Rachel, that really the question is, what determines our priorities? Right now, politics is preventing Darfur from becoming the priority that conscience demands it be. So here you have faith leaders saying, politics is not solving this, so people of faith must act, and conscience, moral conscience, and we would
people
say
have more than
religious
our
conscience.
Our faith too, Jim. The people have more than simply our faith. I would suggest that like-minded people of good faith in the world of Islam need to act and can act and will be a part of resolving this crisis. So I'm sorry for interjecting that.
No, that's
thought,
right.
But
that's helpful.
It is the point I'm making here.
And I should say that this Evangelicals for Darfur is we want to act in concert with other Christians, people of other faith traditions, and people of goodwill. But there's specifically an evangelical voice, for the reasons you've heard stated here today, that must be raised because of the unique position of evangelicals, particularly in this country and around the world. And so what we're saying, it's time to change our priorities about what's on the front burner, what's on the top of the list, what's on the front page, and we can't let the people of Darfur fall off the list of our priorities. And so if politics can't do that, then people of faith have to say, no, our priorities have to be dictated by conscience now, and not just by politics.
Our next question comes from the site of Robert Morris with Associated Baptist Press. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Well, Rachel sort of took my question, but I want to come at this sort of same idea in a different way. Could part of the problem be, and this is for Dr. Land or anyone else who'd like to jump in, could part of the problem be that given this week's revelations in the David Quo book, is the White House perhaps not listening to evangelicals the way evangelicals think they are?
Well, it's always a possibility, although David, in his letter to the president, was very praised the president particularly and was recounting all the accomplishments of the faith-based office. So I don't know if David was not telling the truth then or he's not telling the truth now. That's a question you would need to ask David. Alan Cooperman, who's also on this call, I was on his radio program, and he asked me the question. He said, David Quo says that all that evangelicals have gotten from the administration are trinkets. And I said, I would personally hesitate to call Chief Justice Roberts and Associate Justice Alito and the Child Dependent Care Tax Credit and the reduction in the marriage tax penalty trinkets. It's not been my experience that the administration has not been listening to evangelicals. I've dealt with every administration from Reagan forward, and I would have to say that this administration has been more open to evangelicals and their concerns than any of the other administrations I've dealt with, and one reason is that there are more evangelicals staffing it at the mid-levels. But I don't think anyone who's been around this president or has seen this president talk about Sudan and talk about Darfur can doubt his concern about this issue and his commitment to this issue. I don't think what I'm trying to do in joining this coalition is to help enable the president to be empowered to do what it's in the president's heart to do.
We'll take our next question from the site of Michelle Vu with the Christian Post. Please go ahead.
This question is for Reverend Richard Cizik and Dr. Land. Richard Cizik had said that when evangelicals speak, the government listens. Why do you think the government and world leaders are so interested in the evangelical voice?
Oh, I'm sorry, was that Pauline?
No, this is Michelle.
Michelle, I'm sorry. Who were you asking?
She was asking you, Rich, first, and then me.
I believe that evangelicals and conservative Catholics are the moral voice of gravity, you know, in America, the center. And to the extent that we reflect our constituencies is the extent to which the rest of society follows. Why would anyone listen to us? It's not really, in my opinion, because government may or may not listen. I believe that what evangelicals say is important because religion and faith is a leading indicator of the rest of society and also of politics. So what we think politically as a movement is what is going to be reflected in culture and society and then also politics. So getting our voices on one page as a movement is not easy. You all are not neophytes to this reality. But when we do speak unifiedly on issues, as we have on this one today, I think that it's not just our government that will listen. The American people will pay attention, and ultimately, I believe, foreign capitals will pay attention. And I think also Arab capitals are paying attention, too, on this subject.
My answer is going to be a little more pedestrian. It's because we're the growth factor in American religion. America is a religious country. It has always been a religious country. And I would refer you to Walter Russell Mead's article in the September-October issue of Foreign Affairs, where he points out that evangelicals have been growing at a spectacular pace over the last 30 years, while mainline Protestants have been atrophying. And so as a consequence, you have evangelicals making up a much larger percentage of the American population. And since we live in a democracy with representative government, as Walter Russell Mead points out, in 1980, 10% of the congressmen and senators identified themselves as born-again evangelicals. In 2006, 25% of the congressmen and senators identify themselves as born-again evangelicals. Now, that's still smaller than our percentage of the population, which is estimated to be somewhere between 34 and 40% of the population. But that's why they listen, because there are more of us. There are a lot more of us than there used to be, and we have, I think, successfully, at least in terms of consensus, dealt with a pietistic streak in our background that we shouldn't get involved in public policy and we shouldn't get involved in foreign policy, and we now are doing that, and because of our numbers, aided and abetted, I might say, by millions and millions of traditional Catholics with whom we share much in common. You know, the Protestant-Catholic divide is really a meaningless one in many ways today. I use this example all the time. I've got more in common with Pope John Paul II and with Pope Benedict on many moral and social and public policy issues than I do with someone who's a liberal Baptist, and he's got more, and the Pope has more in common with me than he does with a liberal Catholic. So the question is not so much whether you're Protestant or Catholic, but where you stand on these sort of traditional values issues. And there's a lot of common ground between traditional Catholics and evangelicals, which who are two very large and sizable parts of the American population constituency.
And the new sort of factor in all this is that evangelicals are not a monolithic voice. There's progressive evangelicals, so-called conservative evangelicals, who both have signed this ad. And you see a whole new generation of evangelicals talking about poverty and the environment as creation care and HIV/AIDS and of course, you know, and Iraq and foreign policy and now Darfur. And when we can come together, when an issue is not about Republicans or Democrats, conservatives or liberals, even Christians or Muslims, when it's about compassion and the commands of God, which this is about, you're going to see us come together across our sometimes differences and other questions. So evangelicals are speaking no longer with a monolithic voice, and a lot of us get a lot of inspiration from previous movements in the 19th century here in 18th century Britain, where evangelicals helped lead the way in abolishing slavery and for women's suffrage and child labor law reform, big issues. And Darfur, I think, could be one of those issues for us now again.
And quickly, as the evangelical church continues to change in respect to more, in America, more Hispanic, more African-American, mm-hmm. globally, as the evangelical church goes beyond the traditional base, we're going to continue to see issues like Darfur and issues of social justice and compassion be more in the forefront. So what we're seeing here with Darfur is actually the beginning and not the end of a brand new narrative in the evangelical church.
And I think you see an example of that in the evangelical involvement on North Korea and the North Korea Human Rights Act and a lot of the leadership taken there by Korean-American evangelicals joined by other evangelicals in America to insist that human rights be part of our dealings with North Korea.
Our next question comes from the side of Nathan Gutman with The Forward. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. I'd like to ask about the Jewish involvement in the Darfur issue. The Sudanese government is trying to portray the international involvement in Darfur as some kind of a Jewish issue. I think President al-Bashir called it a Zionist Jewish organization that's standing behind this whole international intervention. How do you think the evangelical part in the Darfur campaign can change this impression that the Sudanese government is trying to make?
This is Jeff Tunnicliffe. I think I can respond to that. The World Evangelical Alliance is part of the Save Darfur campaign, which is headed, involves a number of faith groups, including a number from the Jewish community, Islamic community. We're also part of the internationalization of Save Darfur, and again, it includes many different faith communities, not only Jewish, Christian, but all Islamic. And so it's just simply not true, obviously. This is a interfaith commitment from people of goodwill and all the different faith communities saying this genocide has to stop.
Our next question comes from the site of Joshua Montez with Family News in Focus. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My question is geared toward anyone. Look down the road for us. If we don't intervene as American evangelicals, and this situation is allowed to carry on and the genocide wipe out the people in Darfur, what message does that send?
Well, this is Dr. Land. As I mentioned earlier, there are would-be perpetrators of genocide and ethnic cleansing in capitals of countries around the world who are waiting to see what's going to happen. And if Khartoum is able to successfully perpetrate the ethnic cleansing and genocide of Darfur, then we will see dictators in other countries draw the conclusion that they can do it too, and that they can do it, and that the world community may protest and the world community may speak out against it, but in the end the world community will do nothing about it. And so my prediction is that we will either effectively intervene as a world community and say that there are certain minimal standards of civilized behavior that we will enforce, and we will not allow governments to sink below, and we will have a much brighter 21st century. Or if we fail to stop the genocide in Darfur, then we will see this type of genocide perpetrated in ever larger numbers in different countries on every continent in the world.
I would add, old notions of national sovereignty can't be allowed to justify genocide. And what's happening now is, when I say politics is failing, the veto on the part of Khartoum here or a few other nations it right now just stops the process. People want to do the right thing, and then it gets vetoed. So these vetoes that prevent conscience from becoming operational have to be defied. And Richard is right. If that doesn't happen, if the worst-case scenarios play out in Darfur, you won't just have horrendous suffering and death in Darfur. This will be a signal to the rest of the world that the world is not going to protect the most vulnerable. And as a Christian, this strikes right to the heart of the gospel when Jesus says, "As you've done to the least of these, you've done to me." So at some point, we have to defy politics in the name of God, and that's exactly what this project is doing.
Let me add a thought, too, here, that I don't think most Americans understand this conflict to be, but I do. And it's that Khartoum represents terrorism, and extremists appear as a recurring tradition in Islam. It's all the way back to the 7th century through medieval assassins on to the modern day followers of Osama bin Laden. And extremists, terrorists, will take lives to further their goals. And so from my vantage point, I'm only speaking for myself, that's what has to be understood is occurring here. Now, not by the words, for example, of Bernard Lewis, is Islam itself tolerative of this kind of behavior, right? Over the history, Bernard Lewis says Islam has taught people of different races to live in brotherhood and people of different religious beliefs and creeds to live by side in reasonable tolerance. Well, in this case, not just the West, but the entire world would be allowing terrorism to continue unabated if this isn't curtailed. And that, the future, which I don't think any of us anywhere in the world want or would countenance.
We'll take our next question from the site of Tony Carnes with Christianity Today. Please go ahead.
I'd like to follow up on what Ms. Banagiri asked at the beginning, is why now. Do you have some particular specific evidence that there is more dying and killing within the last month or two, or is this just based on historical perspective? This could go to anyone, but I'd like to ask Dr. Land this and Rich Cizik this.
Well, I think that the we have been saying the right things, and the Bush administration has been clear and strong on this. The president's speech to the General Assembly last month said to the people of Darfur, "You have suffered unspeakable violence, and my nation has called these atrocities what they are, genocide." The Security Council has approved a resolution that would transform the African Union force into a blue-helmeted force that is larger and more robust. If the Sudanese government does not approve this peacekeeping force quickly, the United Nations must act, he said. Your lives and the credibility of the United Nations is at stake. So I think that what's different now is that we've gone through the international community. The United Nations has acted, at least in terms of resolution. It's now time to go from resolution to action. And we've reached a critical point where, you know, if you cry wolf and you cry wolf and you cry wolf and nothing happens, then you lose your credibility. And the world community is at risk of losing its credibility with genocidal governments and would-be genocidal governments around the world. And the dying has gone on unabated. And the African Union force is exhausted and is faltering in its limited ability to stop the killing. And so the UN has acted. The UN resolutions have acted. It's time to enforce the no-fly zone. It's time to insist, with or without the consent of the Khartoum government, that a blue-helmeted force, a robust blue-helmeted force, multinational force, be inserted to stop this genocidal ethnic cleansing.
And the situation isn't stable, it's deteriorating.
That's right.
And the African Union forces are weak, and in fact, a few weeks ago it looked like they were going to be withdrawn. And if that were the case, the aid workers might also leave. And if that were the case, the people would be completely vulnerable. So if security collapses, and it could collapse any day, any week, then what we see now would be escalated in enormous proportions. And so we can't, Richard's right, we can't keep talking about this and do nothing. Words are not protecting the people of Darfur. And until there's a robust peacekeeping force on the ground, and we put politics aside to make that happen, we're not going to be doing what God requires us to do.
Well, just before the election...
There are no further questions at this time.
Thank you. All right, that concludes our press conference. If you want an MP3 recording, then please call Jack Pennell, P-A-N-N-E-L-L, at 202-745-4614, or Alex Howe at 202-822-5200, extension 245. Or you can email Mr. Pennell, jpennell@sojo, that's S-O-J-O, .net.
We might also say there are radio ad spots going out this week on Salem Christian Broadcasting across the country as well with the same message.
Great. Okay. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This does conclude your teleconference for today. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time, and have a wonderful day.